you know, these are our issues, and we all want to stand up here and say, we're done. We're done with this. You can't just walk over us anymore.
Alaskans join the pipeline protest in North Dakota. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 8th. Good evening. I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, the debate continues over hunting predators.
And this is totally unacceptable from a biological point of view, and particularly on the National Wildlife Refuges, because the refuges are required to maintain the population.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
One person is dead and another wounded after an armed conflict yesterday in the community of Chivac. An Alaska State Troopers dispatch said 24-year-old Harold Panayak shot a village police officer, then turned the gun on himself and died. According to another VPO, the suspect shot 40-year-old officer Derek McDonald three times before taking his own life. The wounded officer was medevaced to a hospital in Anchorage for treatment of life-threatening injuries. Tribal officials from Chivac suspect alcohol to have been a factor in the incident. Panayak was a cross-country runner who placed in the state competition in high school. His next of kin have been notified of his death. Members of the One People Canoe Society from Juneau paddled in unison today down the Missouri River in North Dakota. The trip is a show of solidarity with the Standing Rock Sioux, who are protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline project. A federal court is expected to rule on whether the pipeline construction will go forward tomorrow. Elizabeth Hardball from Alaska's Energy Desk talked with one Alaskan who's there.
Wearing traditional hats and blue life vests, the Alaskans are there to help protest an oil pipeline. If it's built, the pipeline would carry oil from North Dakota to Illinois. Developer Energy Transfer Partners says the pipeline is the safest way to carry the oil, but the Standing Rock Sioux are worried the pipeline could contaminate their water. Catherine Edwards, who is from Juneau but now lives in Washington, is a member of the Tlingit and Haida Central Council. She was standing on a windy hill waiting for her daughter, who was helping paddle the canoe. Before they started down the river, Edwards says the group held a ceremony with water they brought from the Pacific Northwest.
They brought the water down with them, poured it in, did a water ceremony, poured it into the river, and says, we now stand with you in your body of water to keep it protected, to keep it safe.
Edwards says there's a feeling of unity among the protesters.
I mean, you can feel it. You can feel it's a movement. You can feel it's a shift. You can feel people coming together and you know, hi, where are you from? You know, these are our issues. Our issues are similar to yours. And we all want to stand up here and say, we're done. We're done with this. You can't just walk over us anymore.
Several national news outlets reported some violent clashes between demonstrators and private security guards, and the National Guard was called in. But Edwards says organizers are emphasizing nonviolent protests. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
The state approved its first licenses for marijuana businesses today, a major step for prospective retailers hoping to open shop before year's end.
Okay, is there anybody in opposition to the approval of this license? Hearing none, the license is approved. Delegate.
Officially, the state's first shop to be approved was Fairbanks' Frozen Buds. The first for Anchorage is called Enlighten Alaska, located in Spinard. Jane Stinson is one of the co-owners of the business and says getting the license is a major step forward.
What this means to us is that we have a lot of work to do. So this will allow us to start our build out or continue with it and then start communicating, networking with all of our vendors and the folks who have already received their cultivation licenses.
The state's Marijuana Control Board has already approved dozens of cultivation licenses, allowing commercial growers to move ahead. Though a few businesses have already received local approval, others, like Stinson's, are still scheduled to go before local governments for another review process. Today, the board also approved the first licenses for manufacturing facilities, which are businesses that plan on making products like edibles and concentrates for sale in shops. Major questions about the transportation, financing, and security of commercial cannabis are still being figured out, even as officials, entrepreneurs, and customers grapple with fast approaching sales. A Washington man has been indicted for fraudulently taking about $2.7 million from Alaskans. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Alaska is charging 55-year-old Floyd J. Mann Jr. with 11 counts of wire fraud and 8 counts of money laundering. Mann allegedly told his victims that he was going to receive millions of dollars from a class-action lawsuit with a pharmaceutical company. He promised the victims that if they helped pay his medical expenses and legal fees, he would give them a substantial portion of the settlement. Instead, Mann gambled with the money at a casino and won more than $1 million. Assistant U.S. Attorney Ani Stewart says concerned family and friends alerted law enforcement to the scheme. The investigation involved the IRS, the FBI, and the Social Security Administration. She says this type of scheme is fairly common, but that this one just was more successful than most. Stewart says more than a dozen victims gave money to Mann, and many of them were close to retirement age.
I mean, I've seen this in a lot of different fraud cases where, you know, elderly folks will be targeted and be bilked of a lot of money because they're not asking the same kind of questions and researching in the same way that somebody more familiar with computers in this day and age would do.
Mann's wife, Cheryl Mann, was also charged with one count of Social Security fraud. She continued to receive need-based benefits, even though she and her husband were earning hundreds of thousands of dollars at the casino. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the next astronaut could come from Alaska.
I do think that there are a lot of similarities between remote parts of Alaska in the wintertime and the kind of difficult environment that we'll no doubt face on other planets.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors are mentors and friends on campus and online. UAS.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
The outcome of the disputed primary contest between Representative Benjamin Nagyak and Dean Westlake is uncertain. Whoever wins, it may unsettle what's been a unique tradition in Alaska politics. Democratic legislators have a long history of joining Republican-led legislative majorities. Andrew Kitchenman of APRN and KTOO in Juneau reports on this past and what could happen next.
To understand why Alaska is so different, it pays to go back to the 1960s. Democrats dominated Alaska, but a resurgent Republican Party disrupted that. Regional divisions prevented a single party from forming a legislative majority, so lawmakers turned to partners across the aisle. Willie Hensley is a Democrat who caucused with members of both parties in the House and Senate in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, representing Kotzebue and the North Slope. He says rural legislators were able to accomplish much during periods of bipartisan politics. They worked to allow village children to attend locally controlled schools, improve rural access to affordable power, and build local housing authorities.
Partly because we were able to put ourselves in a position of influence with these various coalitions that enabled a lot of that to happen.
Rural lawmakers became power brokers in the legislature. For example, in 1981, then-Representative Al Adams of Kotzebue led a mid-session revolt in which rural Democrats joined with Republicans to switch control of the House. And every Republican-led House majority since then has had at least one Bush Democratic caucus member. But by the late 1990s, Bush legislators had become fragmented, with members split between the majority and minority caucuses. Mary Sattler represented Bethel from 1999 to 2009 and chose not to caucus with the majority.
My focus was really on building the Bush caucus back up to where it had been in the 70s and 80s.
Sattler says that even minority caucus rural lawmakers were able to build relationships that led to capital projects in their districts.
One of the kind of hallmarks of rural legislators is, you know, it's a lot like rural Alaskans, where we tend to be very non-confrontational. We much prefer governing with consensus, and you know, being confrontational and combative doesn't work really well if you're from a small town and intend on living in a small town.
The rural lawmakers faced challenges in recent years to maintain their influence. Alaska's population is increasingly urban, which means fewer rural seats in the legislature. And as the drops in oil prices and production have shrunk the state's capital budget, rural lawmakers haven't been able to bring home as many state dollars to villages with small economies. Now it's the Republican Party that usually leads in state politics, and all four Democratic House members from northern and western Alaska have caucused with the Republicans since House Speaker Mike Chenault invited them to join in 2008. Chenault says this has allowed his caucus to include a broader range of voices.
It made our caucus stronger because at that point in time, we represented all areas of the state from Barrow to Nome to ADAC to Ketchikan and all areas in between, and it made us a better caucus in our opinion.
Representative Nagiak's predecessor, Reggie Jewell, says that after spending 12 years in the minority, he chose to join the majority in 2008. He says this gave rural lawmakers a say in the budget, including the capital budget.
You know, I tried throwing rocks before, and sometimes we were quite effective. But when you're inside the tent, you can make your case inside the tent on what's important and still stay true, I think, to many of the values that you hold dear.
Voters generally have reelected rural Democratic legislators who crossed party lines, and these lawmakers have faced few primary challenges from other Democrats. That pattern changed this year, with state Democratic leaders supporting Dean Westlake over Nagiak, as well as Zach Fansler in his successful bid to unseat Bethel Representative Bob Herron. Former University of Alaska Southeast political scientist Clive Thomas says the drop in the capital budget may be causing the changed approach.
Maybe now that there's no capital money or no capital budget, really there's nothing in it for the Democrats to be quiet about this.
Opinions are split over whether the primary challenges this year will lead to long-term changes in how rural Democrats choose to caucus. But as House Democrats aim to build a bipartisan coalition that would include moderate Republicans, it could have an effect on the next legislature. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
A series of predator hunting restrictions for national wildlife refuges in Alaska took effect on Tuesday. That same day, Governor Bill Walker said that the state is organizing a lawsuit against the federal government to oppose the new rules, and Alaska's congressional delegation is looking for ways to reverse the changes as well. But as of now, the rules are in effect on Alaska's national wildlife refuges, prompting at least a few hunters to change their plans. From Galena, KIYU's Tim Bodoni reports.
The new rules ban certain hunting practices, such as the same-day airborne hunting of bears and the taking of brown bears over bait, which had been allowed to occur on refuge land under state regulations. Though the Fish and Wildlife Service identified those techniques as leading to the non-subsistence take of predators, the new restrictions will still apply to federally qualified subsistence users like Galena's Charlie Green.
We had plans with some other friends to go to Three Day Slough, which is on federal land, to do some grizzly bear baiting on the 17th of September, so this is going to have to change our plan.
Green says that he retains the hides from any grizzly bears he takes, but the meat is only good for trapping bait. He was one of many local hunters in Galena who spoke out against the new federal rules when they were proposed earlier this year, in part because they take efficient predator control options off of the table, but also because the rules seem motivated more by politics than any conservation concerns. When the Fish and Wildlife Service published the final version of the rules in early August, agency director Dan Ash portrayed the rules as a necessary defense against what he considered inhumane hunting practices that are often endorsed by the Alaska Board of Game. Dr. David Raskin, president of the citizen group Friends of Alaska National Wildlife Refuges, agrees.
The state of Alaska has engaged in a very aggressive campaign over the years to eliminate predators throughout the state, and this is totally unacceptable from a biological point of view, and particularly on the National Wildlife Refuges, because the refuges are required to maintain the populations in their natural states.
Raskin argues that the current rules don't go far enough and would like to see the Fish and Wildlife Service ban the use of all bait to hunt any type of bear, including the use of gut piles from legally killed game animals like moose. That practice is still permitted on refuge land because a gut pile at a kill site does not fit the definition of bait, according to the new regulations. The latest volley in the legal and political battle over the new rules occurred on September 6th, when Governor Bill Walker told the Alaska Journal of Commerce that the state is coordinating with other opponents of the new rules to file a lawsuit. It's unclear when that suit will be filed. Alaska's congressional delegation in Washington is also opposed to the new rules. Earlier this year, Congressman Don Young attached a provision to the Interior Department Appropriations Bill forbidding the Fish and Wildlife Service from spending any money on enforcing the new rules. That bill passed the House as amended and is now awaiting action in the Senate. Young spokesperson Matt Shukaro says that the predator hunting restrictions go against the spirit and letter of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA.
And, you know, that law protects Alaska's ability to manage wildlife across all areas of our state, so private and federal lands. And so we're going to see an increasingly attack on that ability, that special, unique relationship that Alaska has defined in law. And it is the delegation's responsibility to stand up to those, to enforce the law, and to ensure that Alaska's unique relationship with the federal government is protected.
Even if attempts to derail the rules in court and in Congress don't work, the Federal Subsistence Board can overturn parts of the rule in specific areas for subsistence users. But for now, the hunting of brown bears over bait, the same-day airborne hunting of bears, the trapping of bears, and the taking of wolves and coyotes during the denning season are forbidden on Alaska's National Wildlife Refuges. Given that the new regulations are coming into effect just as hunters are headed out into the field for fall season hunts, Kaikuk, Nawitna, and Anoko National Wildlife Refuge manager Kenton Mose in Galena says that his agency will have to walk a fine line.
Obviously, we need to do our part to educate the public. And now with that said, our law enforcement officers are out and about. And as with all game regulations and so forth, they will take appropriate measures when they see violations in progress.
Most says that whether or not individuals are cited for violating the new rules will depend largely on the discretion of wildlife enforcement officers. In Galena, this is Tim Bodoni.
Efforts to stem riverbank erosion along a stretch of the Matanuska River have been largely successful. A massive job by the Department of Transportation is keeping water from flooding the Old Glenn Highway near Palmer. As Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer reports, the current work was spurred by emergency conditions, but it's unclear if it'll solve a recurring problem.
DOT work crews were dumping massive rocks, some weighing 3,000 pounds, into an 1,100-foot trench constructed along the Matanuska River to help divert river water from reaching the highway and swamping the electric utility lines that border the road. About 40 homes along a 2-mile stretch of riverbank are threatened by erosion, and the fast disappearing bank is allowing river water to creep uncomfortably close to the Old Glenn Highway. Department of Transportation spokesperson Shannon McCarthy says to date, the project has been largely successful in holding the water back from the highway.
By putting this rock in, it deflects the river, that force of the river, away from the road.
The state authorized a disaster declaration for the Matanuska-Susitna Borough on August 22nd, triggering the release of $1 million in state funds to begin the work. McCarthy says the state has released another $1 million in funds from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to pay for the remainder of the erosion mitigation. But the erosion problem has been going on for years in the Butte as well as in other river communities such as Sutton to the north. Butte resident Calvin Hall lives near the river and has been watching the most recent project carefully.
It's a band-aid that I don't think was overly well thought out. They didn't have a lot of time
But a big picture, it doesn't solve much of anything. There's way too many other places where this river can fail and go right across the highway and do a pretty devastating flood.
Hall says the river current naturally forms gravel bars in the riverbed that push water into one channel or another. He says material carried by the current is dumped on the west bank, pushing the water to the opposite side, which causes the erosion. Hall says dredging the riverbed is one solution. Borough Assemblyman Jim Sykes says he agrees, but the cost and constant maintenance of a dredging plan is prohibitive at this time. Sykes is also keeping a close eye on the work, which also has built a rock wall along the riverbank to shore up the erosion-prone areas.
It was kind of a dicey deal, and when you have this embankment that's simply made up of silt and gravel, it doesn't have much structure, and the water is trying to erode it away, it's not an easy force to deal with.
The borough and the state have been squabbling over who will pay for the mitigation work for years, ever since the river washed away a flood control dike built in the 1980s. Borough spokesperson Patty Sullivan says the borough is prohibited from working on the state-owned river. The borough can only work on borough land, she says, adding that the borough had proposed a special assessment area for Riverside homeowners 3 years ago to help pay for erosion abatement. That proposal was turned down. Sykes, who toured the site on Thursday, says the erosion control work is successful, at least for the time being. He adds that the new level of cooperation between the state and the borough could result in a permanent fix for the problem. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors or mentors and friends on campus and online. UAS.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
As fall time rolls in and the air takes on a familiar chill, Kuskokwim residents are beginning their subsistence activities, and that requires traveling in conditions that can quickly turn hostile. KYUK's Charles Enoch got some advice on staying safe along the river from two members of Bethel Search and Rescue.
It's fall and families race the seasons, waning daylight and cooling weather to fill their freezers before the river freezes. Fall weather on the Kuskokwim is known to be rainy, windy, and often unpredictable. Bethel Search and Rescue Chief Mike Riley gives hunters and travelers some tips.
Make sure you do a float plan or tell someone where you're going at all times, when you're supposed to be back. Take enough supplies, enough gas to make a round trip, and plus an extra in case you ran into any problems or anybody else out there that needed help. Also, always make sure that you wear your life jacket out there. Try not to be traveling during dark hours, please. You know, it makes it danger, that not just for you, but also for other people out there also.
Riley adds that travelers should also bring extra warm clothing in case someone has to spend a night in the cold. Bethel Search and Rescue is a volunteer group that searches for missing persons. They are based in Bethel, and its members include avid hunters and travelers from different villages in the region. Daylight decreases dramatically during fall. Many people find themselves running out of light before they head home. Riley says it's easy to get lost traveling by boat at night.
Problems we see in the past is that people being out at night and they don't know where they're at during the dark time. They'll be traveling and they'll try to remember where they're going, and sometimes it makes it a little bit harder for us to find them because they're not where they're supposed to be.
Riley says time is an issue when you're looking for someone who hasn't made it home from a trip. The shores on the Kuskokwim are slate-colored and often impossible to see in the dark, even for the most experienced travelers. There are also hazards like submerged logs, shallow areas, and debris that can be hidden even without darkness. Former Bethel Search and Rescue Chief Peter Achak of Bethel says anybody can find themselves in a tough spot in the wilderness.
A lot of people think that, you know, these tragedies or accidents may never happen to them. But tragedies and accidents happen to anyone.
Riley says a recent deadly accident hit close to home last month when his 25-year-old nephew from the Yukon village of Pitgas Point, Thaddeus Riley, ran into a submerged log with two others in the boat. The two swam to shore, but Thaddeus Riley swam for the boat and drowned. He was not wearing a life preserver.
This is something that anybody that knew him didn't think anything like this was going to happen to him. But that tells you that be prepared, you know, always, you know, things can happen to the most experienced people out there.
As Kuskokwim residents gather food for the winter, travel to Bethel to shop in a bigger store, or are just out enjoying the autumn, Riley says be safe and always, always wear your life jacket. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
One of NASA's new astronauts could come from Fairbanks. A University of Alaska Fairbanks researcher has been selected by NASA as one of 100 finalists for the job. More than 18,000 people applied. International Arctic Research Center and Institute for Northern Engineering Associate Professor Jessica Cherry's work focuses on water and climate. She says a lot of the tools she uses have applications in the space program.
Weather station observations, and I do a lot of airborne research. I'm also a commercial pilot. I do imaging and air chemistry sampling.
Cherry previously interviewed with NASA's astronaut program in 2012 and describes a multifaceted screening.
Several-day process of individual interviews, group interviews, language and intelligence testing, some physical testing, that sort of thing.
Cherry says the space program's new focus includes going to Mars or an asteroid, destinations that, as an Alaskan, she feels well-suited for.
I do think that there are a lot of similarities between remote parts of Alaska in the wintertime and the kind of difficult environment that we'll no doubt face on other planets.
Cherry heads to Houston, Texas, to interview at the Johnson Space Center later this month. She says 50 candidates will be advanced to the next stage in the selection process. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Charles Enoch and Adrian Wagner in Bethel, Elizabeth Harbaugh and Ellen Locke here in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Tim Bedoni in Galena. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Ben Matheson is our web editor, and Hillman produced tonight's show, and I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbaalaska.com. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program. The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors are mentors and friends on campus and online. UAS.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.